Welcome to Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this edition, three strategies for parents of young children to use to make the most of failure. Our guest is psychologist Dan Florell. For Jason Thompson, it was a choice between finishing a PhD in communications at UK or following his entrepreneurial instincts. Suffice it to say, he didn't hang the PhD on his office wall.
I did not. I got halfway through, and we started opening all these businesses, and I got a little too busy.
And you'll probably recognize what he's been busy with. Also, we'll be brought up to date by Ashton Potter-Wright about Lexington's farm-to-table programs. To start the hour, we want to tell you about something called the New Energy Internship Program. It's a key part of efforts by MESED, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, to create a new energy economy in eastern Kentucky. Funded by the Appalachian Regional Commission, the program offers former coal industry employees six-month internships fielding positions that advance energy efficiency in the region. And two of them are right here with us. We'd like to welcome Scott Shoup and John Kraft. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And John, you're from Hazard?
Hazard.
And Scott, you're from Benham?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to begin by asking each of you to tell us a little bit of background about your coal industry experience and how that came to an end. John, you want to start?
Okay. I went to work in the late 70s in surface mines and worked at that for a few years and then went to work for the telephone company in Leslie County, Kentucky, doing telephone installation, troubleshooting. And then I was offered a job at Shamrock Coal Company, and the money was so much better, I went to that in 82.
And that was underground?
Underground, yes.
Uh-huh. And how about you, Scott?
I actually spent 22 years underground. That's all I ever worked was underground coal mining. I came out last year in 2018 in July. I started as most people in the coal industry, just a young kid out of high school, no education besides high school. Started as an independent, inexperienced miner, worked my way up, got my foreman's papers, actually left Kentucky in 2012 when the industry declined, went to work in West Virginia, then ended up going to Alabama and working a couple years underground.
And John mentioned that the money can be pretty good. It makes it hard to turn it down, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And, that's why I say, with me, I started out just, your average coal miner. And then I ended up, was a superintendent over my own coal mines. And I went out to Alabama and was over a mines that had three setup sections and a longwall.
And you all have come out of this with, among other things, black lung.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You bring all that experience that you had in the industry to this program that MESED has underway, the New Energy Internship Program. And if you would, tell us a little bit about what that is, what you're doing in that program.
Through MESED's program, we have become certified in energy efficiency and building analysis. So we do tests on buildings to determine where they're using energy that they don't need to be using and how they can correct those issues to make businesses, I guess, be more profitable and some community organizations to keep the doors open.
And it's a six-month program, is that right?
Yes.
How far along are you all?
We're actually within the last couple months. April the 1st will effectively be our own business.
While you're going through this, are you paid?
Yes, sir. Yes. It's a six-month paid internship. Uh-huh. MESED treats you as a full-time employee. They give you health benefits, vision, dental, retirement plan. Everything that they offer to their full-time employees, they offer to the internship. So I've been very pleased and blessed with it. I was to the point in the coal industry to where, I was tired of moving. I was tired of chasing money. I was tired of packing my family up or being away from my family. And I seen this as an opportunity to not only better myself, but bring something back to my community that I care about.
And so this is a real bridge from that to something new.
That's right. Exactly.
So what are you going to do with this? Yeah, whichever one of you wants to start, and we'll talk to both of you about it.
My plans post-internship is, you know, to develop a company, you know, that provides energy services throughout Kentucky, but with a primary focus on Eastern Kentucky, as close to home as I can stay with it. And my end result is bring back to the communities by providing some good jobs for people, you know, that pay well, that they can support their families with, that we currently don't have.
John Kraft, how about you?
My plan is the same, to start a company doing energy efficiency work, consulting and testing, report work, and retrofit work also. Also doing the labor on retrofits. And hopefully at some point down the line, I'll be able to provide jobs and develop a viable company.
Now, I know that you also have done work with at-risk kids in the area. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The agency that I worked for, what we've seen is a huge increase in abuse and neglect reports in the state since 2008.
What do you think that's related to?
Drugs.
And economic downturn, harder times.
Maybe both.
Yeah.
Combination of the two.
Yeah, I think so.
It sounds as though what you two are doing is something very positive. And do you know of other former coal industry workers, coal miners, that are doing similar internship programs or trying to turn away from the coal industry and find some new path in their life?
Yes. I personally have a lot of friends that, you know, have in the last, 5 years left the coal industry, you know, trying to pursue something different. But I've also seen a big percentage of them in the recent year time frame that the industry has peaked back up a little bit. I've also seen a big percentage of them jumping back in. I think that's one of the bridges, you know, that we have to find a gap for.
I was studying the Mayshead website before I talked to you all, and I came across a statement that went like this. Though Appalachia's narrative is shifting, residents often still do not understand how they fit in the region's new economy. Do you think part of that wariness might have to do with fear of the unknown, actually not being able to quite see what's on the other side? What do you think that's about?
I mean, I think that people in southeastern Kentucky have got so blinded by coal and everything being so centered around coal severance tax, you know, your local city, county governments are all structured from coal severance tax money. And I think everybody's just been so overwhelmed and so blinded by coal that they can't see outside of it. And I think that's where that these type of programs and nonprofits like MACID and Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, I think that's where they fit in and where that they are doing an excellent job with reaching out to people and letting people see that there is ways and there's things that we can do to overcome the economies and the situations that we're in and make them viable again.
What do you think, John?
I think that organizations like MACID, like KFTC, are like out in front. They're like leading the charge to restructure the economy in Eastern Kentucky. And I think that's something that we have to do.
Do you think it's possible for Eastern Kentucky to turn the corner away from coal, given what you just said, Scott, and find new ways to bring some sort of alternate prosperity to the region?
I think so, absolutely.
What comes to mind when you're thinking about, you're sitting back and you're thinking, if I could change this area and take it forward, what do you think would work? Of course, if you have that answer, everybody's going to beat the path to your door for sure.
Exactly. But, I mean, I think one of our biggest attractions could be you know, tourism. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't see any reason why, with the rich history of coal that we have and the coal camp history and, you know, coal companies building these little cities, you know, that's just like the town I grew up in, Benham, Kentucky, was built by International Harvester. They built that city. And U.S. Steel built the city of Lynch. And, you know, there's a lot of history there, and there's a lot of good things that have come out of that, and there still is a lot of things that can come out of that good. And I think that's where our focus needs to be, is generate our communities as a major tourist attraction.
Are there some things that need to happen to get there that
you
see?
I mean, yeah, there is things. There's going to be investments, and it's going to take money, and it's going to take some, you know, rebuilding and some infrastructure. But, you know, the foundation is there. You know, they always say, you know, build your foundation on a rock. I think what we have in the mountains of eastern Kentucky is a solid rock.
How about you, John? You agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also think that eastern Kentucky could still be a leader in energy production. We have been since the late 1800s. We fueled the big push through the war with coal, the steel industry. I think that we have acres and acres and acres of land on top of the mountains, huge solar farms, develop a whole workforce to service them. We have the transmission lines here because the coal-fired power plants were here. So why can't we feed those other areas with power produced here?
Scott Shoup and John Kraft, former coal miners, now enrolled in MESED's new energy internship program. Thank you for being here with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And if you want to know more, go online to MESED, that's MACED.org. Later in the hour, Ashton Potter Wright here to update us on the Bluegrass Farm to Table Initiative and a Kentucky Food Systems Summit, and Jason Thompson, the entrepreneur behind a trio of successful Lexington brands. Coming up after a short break.
If things go well for us, we are not usually registering like, oh, I need to do this different. Oh, how do I improve this? Because it was fine. But when I fail, it causes me to have to re-examine how I'm doing.
EKU psychologist Dan Florell talks to us about the balance between protecting your child from danger versus allowing them to learn from failure. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their business and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
When something is wrong with my baby, something's wrong with me.
Failure is good for kids. Easy to say, I know. Watching your child fail can make you feel helpless, maybe angry, certainly maybe sad. You worry about everything from your child's self-esteem and social development to their future success. And that worry is perfectly natural, but there are clear benefits to powering through that worry and that angst. There are times when failure and its close companion, consequences, can be productive for kids and a chance for them to change. And let me preface this conversation by saying, heaven knows it's not easy to be a parent, ever. but maybe especially in these times of digital technologies and the necessity of two paychecks to keep everybody housed, healthy, and happy. So it's not about judgment. It's about just taking a few moments to reflect on the value of failure. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Fleurel, a Richmond Register article about childhood failure that you co-wrote with your pediatrician wife, Pravina Salins,
yeah,
caught my eye as a father and a grandfather myself, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of nodding heads here at WEKU as this interview progresses. It's titled Growing Up, Failure, and What to Do Next. And you list a set of strategies that parents can use, and we'll get to them in just a moment. But first, I have some questions.
Sure.
And let's begin by looking at a bad day on the soccer field or not doing well on a math test or as you suggest in your article, having trouble making those Lego parts fit together and getting frustrated to the point of quitting.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it important that we as parents resist the urge to step in and fix these things?
Well, I think, you know, as everybody's well aware, throughout life, you're going to have things that don't go as planned. And if you just simply quit every time that happens, you don't get very far. You don't accomplish very much. But you kind of have to set the table early in childhood. That means children need to experience failure, and they also need to know how to overcome it when they do experience it. So, you know, we wish our lives would go through without any incident and that we would be able to do well in everything that we attempt. But childhood is a great time to start thinking about failure and experiencing it because they're learning everything new. And we know that you don't pick up everything perfectly the very first time. And so failure is something actually most children are used to some degree. But then they experience success and they just assume, oh, this is how it always is going to be. And so I think every parent has had the experience where their child has tried something new and then they just kind of give up and they walk away because they didn't master it the very first time, even if with a little effort they would have. And so we need to be able to model how to overcome that type of failure.
There's an old R&B tune, when something's wrong with my baby, something's wrong with me. Are there benefits to letting your child feel discomfort, which is a hard thing for a parent to do because they viscerally experience it themselves?
Mm-hmm. I think certainly, discomfort, the idea that you didn't do as well as you had wanted to, that is a good motivator. I mean, look at all these businessmen that we celebrate in our society and how successful they are. And inevitably, if you really dig down much, you will see there were multiple failures along the way. And the failure, they'll say, is the best learning opportunity they ever have. If things go well for us, we are not usually registering like, oh, I need to do this different. Oh, how do I improve this? Because it was fine. But when I fail, it causes me to have to reexamine how I'm doing. And of course, for parents, though, that idea that your child is a reflection of you, it can be hard because nobody wants to view themselves as a failure. But I think in the long term, you're going to be much more proud of your children if they are able to fail, pick themselves up on their own, and then go on and persist in whatever their passion happens to be. And so I'm kind of asking for a longer term perspective for parents to take rather than just the immediate reflection off of you.
There's a Chinese symbol for crisis. It's a combination of symbols for danger and opportunity. Is it fair to say that parents naturally see the danger part very clearly in a crisis, but maybe they miss the opportunity part?
I think that hits it very accurately because, we're, as parents, hardwired to pick up on any dangers to our child and try to swoop in and help them. And that's really handy if they're trying to cross this busy street by themselves. But it's not so handy if they miss a kick and lose the game at a soccer match and you want to swoop in and scream at the referees or whoever might be responsible. That failure, that opportunity of failure, I think it's a good one to kind of change your perspective on as a parent and not just automatically think it's a danger to the child, but also look at, is the danger overwhelming? If the danger's overwhelming, then yes, swoop in and help them out. But if the danger is not overwhelming and the failure is going to prompt the child to have to look at things a little differently, I mean, that's kind of your ideal growing up.
I really wonder about that swooping in. I mean, sometimes it's justified. There may be some unfairness of the school system, the child has learning difficulties or a behavioral problem, whatever it is. But
Isn't there a good chance that the child sees this and learns that it's okay if I screw up enough, Mom will take care of it, or Dad has more power than the teacher, so he can take care of it? So the child then learns that power versus owning the problem is the solution.
Well, I think there's certainly the danger of that. You know, children are sponges as far as what they observe, what they're picking up. They're trying to figure out how the world works. And if power plays are the way that they see that, they incorporate that into their own way of acting, you know, down the road. So it's much better to see that, you know, when I do fail, I mean, there are supports. And I'm not saying don't be supportive when a child fails, but there's a difference between, like, say, providing some emotional support and then just coming in and finishing it for them, whatever that problem may be. You know, so if you are dealing with a tough principal you don't feel is fair, you know, you need to encourage the child to go in and talk to the principal first on their own. Now, you know, at some point you may need to intervene, but to do that as almost a default once there's a little bit of failure or difficulty is a real problem as far as what they might pick up later on.
And earlier, we touched on that visceral connectedness we have with our children. We feel their pain. Do we have a tendency to transfer our kids' failures to ourselves, and what should we do about that?
Well, I think certainly, you know, any time that you've invested anything, like the time that you spend in trying to help a child grow up, you're vested, and a lot of your effort is going towards and what you might think the outcome is the child. And so if the child is failing, you think maybe it's a failure on my part. And once again, that's going to lead into the swooping in to save, because it's also a way of saving you. And your whole time commitment and caring and everything else that you've devoted to that relationship. So rather than do that, I think it's a good thing for parents to take the old classic pause and just take a step back whenever they see something like that. Going with your gut reaction to swoop in is, and once again, the long term, probably not going to be as successful. It's much better to go ahead and take a pause and then just really think of, is this really a reflection on me? Is this why I'm doing it? Is, you know, the reason that my son is no longer interested in football, is that because of me? Or is it really because it's not a good fit with my son and he needs to be able to go some of his own path? And I think it's real difficult when you're that invested in something.
Mm-hmm. In your article in the Richmond Register, you talk about persistence and what it teaches and why it's so important. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, all you got to do is hang around adults with kids and you will hear them complain about, you know, kids just don't seem to persist in things. They give up too easily. Where's their work habit? And all that ties together. There's another more modern idea that they talk about, grit, which is also kind of a form of persistence. And it's so important because, like we established earlier, life is full of obstacles, and the only way to overcome them is just to keep grinding it out. Things are not always going to be smooth or be able to overcome easily. And so sometimes that persistence, the just grinding down, is the way you get through some of your obstacles. And if you learn that as a habit early on in life, you're going to be much more successful.
Okay, listen up, parents. Dr. Dan has some strategies for you here, especially if you're going through some of this. You outlined three of them in your article. So let's go through them. First, modeling what persistence looks like.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're not children aren't the only ones that fail in life, right? Adults fail frequently in various things that they do. But I think it's important to go ahead and acknowledge that with the kids, and even taking on what may seem like real trivial type of tasks, but challenging ones. I think the example I used was doing a puzzle. If you've ever done one of those 500 puzzle pieces, all the same size and shape kind of things, you know you're not as successful doing that right off. But if you're discussing and you have the child involved with you and talk about different strategies that you're using to solve a problem, so like the puzzle pieces, you might talk about, okay, boy, that's a lot of pieces and they're so small and the picture is not varied enough. So maybe I'll go ahead and, you know, I've always found it successful if I look for the edges first. I'm going to look for the edges. Can you help me look for the edges? Oh, look, there's a flower in this upper corner. Maybe we'll look at that. Oh, that didn't really work. So in addition to showing the strategies you're using, you need to be completely open about that you're trying a lot of different strategies. strategies, and the child needs to see some are going to work and some don't. And that when they don't, you don't just go, I give up. I'm not doing this puzzle anymore. Rather, you're going to say, oh, well, that didn't really work. We need to probably focus on a different aspect. And you can even solicit their input. But really what you're doing is you're modeling goals, and you may be even setting small, realistic goals to get to the bigger goal. And so rather than just say, let's put this whole puzzle together, you say, okay, let's go ahead and put the edges together. That's a realistic goal. We can try to do that in the time we have right now. And then we're going to go on to the next thing.
Do you think it's okay also to let your children see you powering through your own obstacles in life, you being persistent with grown-up issues that they can witness?
I think to a degree. Obviously, there are some adult problems that probably is best for a child not to see.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I didn't mean all of them.
Yeah, for example, but, you know, if you're going through a divorce, I don't recommend the powering through aspect modeling for the child. But, you know, there are tasks, whether it's, I know a task in our family, we tried to put together some patio furniture. And, you know, if you've ever bought the patio furniture that's not put together, you got to get a lot of different things.
Rolling my eyes over here.
And problem solve, you know, you got braces and grips. And anyway, that is a good example. You know, you're not succeeding. You just kind of got to plunk away. They want to give up. You're like, well, we need to get this done. How are we going to do this next? You know, and that's kind of your everyday tasks. I think, yes, it's perfectly fine to do that. For the bigger stuff, you know, you got to use your own judgment. There are some adult problems that need to remain adult problems that children don't need to be exposed to. But for minor everyday sort of stuff that we all have to kind of grind through, whether it's patio furniture or something else, I certainly advise that kids should be able to see their parents do that.
Okay, strategy number two, praise.
Yeah, I think sometimes we feel praise is as valuable as, you know, dollar bills and almost as rare. But the secret about praise is that you can give it and you can keep on giving it. And now, there are a couple ways to give praise that are better than others. When we're talking about developing persistence, you could give them praise after they finished and they tried real hard. But that means they had to persist with no extra help during the whole task. So what if you can see they're really trying hard and they're not quite done yet, or they are even about halfway through? You could say, whoa, boy, you're putting a lot of energy into this. You know, I think it looks like you're almost getting there.
So encouragement.
Certainly. Encouragement, praise, those are the same things, really. And that encouragement midway might be just enough to provide that external motivation to get the child to kind of persist and overcome. And then, of course, once they do accomplish it, the pride that they have in that. But I don't think we need to be stingy. I think we need to be very generous in our praise. And we also, when we do praise, we need to try to make it more specific to whatever the child's doing. Don't do, I used to call it being a good job jockey, where you kind of just say, oh, good job, good job, good job. And that's not very specific.
It becomes less than genuine after a while.
It does. But if I tell you something specific, then the child is going to know I am noticing what you're doing and what specifically you really are trying hard for. And I think that's going to be the thing that really helps out with the persistence. So, you know, the takeaway there is give lots of encouragement. It's not a rare resource. Don't make it a rare resource. And it pays off dividends. It's almost impossible to overpraise a child if they're really putting forth an extra effort.
Third strategy is providing opportunities for kids to actually practice persistence. What do you have in mind there?
Well, I mean, we all have tasks around the home, and I think a lot of times we sell children short in what they can really do independently. So I'm not saying, you know, tell the child, I want a three-course meal, go figure it out, okay? But you certainly can take little baby steps that, you know, are a little bit beyond what they're comfortable with, but that you have pretty good high confidence that they're going to be able to accomplish. And so, for instance, maybe they want to bake brownies, and they've helped out before, but they've never done it all on their own. Well, you say, okay, this time, I want you to go ahead and bake the brownies on your own. I'll be around, but I want you to go ahead and figure it out. Okay, that would be an example of giving an opportunity for persistence, because they're probably going to have something that doesn't come out quite right. You know, whether it's finding the eggs or the eggshells get into the batter or whatever it might be. But that's what I'm talking about as far as being able to. And maybe they get to a point where they just simply can't and they really want to give up. It's okay for a parent to come in and just give maybe a little guidance. A lot of times it doesn't have to be actually doing the task. It can just be providing the emotional support. So, you know, one of the key caveats I do want to talk about briefly is when we do deal with failure, the failure needs to be within a supportive environment. I'm not saying a child should fail in front of the whole school and then nobody comes in to console them afterwards, right?
Sure.
So
nothing
the
gained
support
from it, really.
No. And I had one interesting study I just ran across, which would be a perfect anti-example of what we're talking about here. They actually did a study of looking at Friday report card releases and the incidence of child abuse that following weekend. And they would be an example of a parent trying, if a child failed, to make them even feel worse about themselves. And that would be the antithesis of providing a supportive environment, you know, and like giving them a whooping or some sort of corporal punishment as a punishment on top of the failure. So that's the example of what you don't want to model. You want to model the, okay, we see you failed this. Now let's go ahead and problem solve and figure out how to make it difference.
What, Dr. Florell, is your message to parents of young children about that light at the end of the tunnel?
Oh, yes. Okay. So here's the light at the end of the tunnel. This is where all that effort at taking a step back and just letting your child maybe experience some failure, because those children who experience failure and then learn how to persist, they're going to be more confident in the skills that they have. They're not going to need constant reassurance that they're good enough because they'll know it. They're going to be more optimistic about things because, once again, they have faith in themselves. Therefore, they're going to be more independent, meaning they're not calling you up when they're 35 years old and needing some extra help because they're going to know how to power through that sort of thing. And then, of course, as you might say, follows, they're going to have higher self-esteem because what comes with confidence where you can overcome in the face of obstacles and failure, well, of course, you're going to feel good about yourself.
Dr. Dan Florell, an associate professor in the psychology department at Eastern Kentucky University, he has a private practice, MindSci, in Richmond. Thanks for sharing these insights, Dr. Florell.
It was great to be here.
When something is wrong with my baby, something is wrong with me.
Coming up after the break, Lexington local food coordinator Ashton Potter-Wright on the coming of spring and with it farm-to-table season. Plus, talk of pulling together all of the pieces to position Lexington as an ag tech hub.
We have a lot of really important assets already in place, and we're kind of at the cusp, we hope, with city's involvement and bringing together these partners, and that we'll really come up with a really great plan to move Lexington forward on this initiative.
And chances are good you're at least aware of one of his brands, Lexington entrepreneur Jason Thompson.
But I think there was a time in which I decided I wanted to be able to create something, do something that I felt like was, at the end of the day, a business or a product that I could say I got off the ground and I was able to do with my business partners rather than work for someone else.
All coming up on Eastern Standard after the break.
With me.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about 119 in Lexington, May 19th through 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
It's one thing to talk about the challenges and rewards of starting and growing your own business, quite another to actually take it from coffee shop napkin to a revenue-generating, jobs-creating, satisfying endeavor. With us today is somebody who has done just that. If you've had a salad in a vinaigrette salad kitchen around Lexington,
or an orange leaf frozen yogurt, or had a blast at a breakout games location, or all of the above, you've done business with Jason Thompson, owner of Orange Consulting of Lexington. Greetings, Jason.
Hey.
So let's first spend a little bit of time talking about entrepreneurialism and how you chose this path instead of landing a 9-to-5 job working for somebody else.
Sure. Yeah. Working for yourself is always, in my opinion, the best possible scenario. You get to make your own hours, sort of. Once you have a business up and running, it kind of forces you to work, certain hours. But I think there was a time in which I kind of decided I wanted to be able to create something and do something that I felt like was, at the end of the day, a business or a product that I could say I got off the ground and I was able to do with my business partners rather than work for someone else.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're originally from Indiana.
That's correct. Yeah.
And where did you go to school?
Heritage Hills High School is where I went in Indiana, a little town called Santa Claus. And then what brought me to Lexington was I was working on a PhD at UK in communications.
And did you get the PhD?
I did not. I got halfway through and we started opening all these businesses and I got a little too busy.
So you went in that direction and the first business you went into, I believe, was Orange Leaf, correct?
That's correct. I came on a little late. I met my now business partners who had gotten started with Orange Leaf Frozen Yogurt as franchisees, and that's based out of Oklahoma City. They opened the first one in Tiverton by the mall, and it just blew up. You know, lines out the door in November. It's freezing cold, and people are wanting Orange Leaf.
That should tell you something.
Yeah, exactly. So they got some funding. Actually, Coach Cal got involved and was able to help us get to the next level. And we opened several more locations after that and grew in Kentucky to about 12, 14 stores.
Another enterprise that a lot of people have seen around town and probably patronized is Vinaigrette, the salad kitchen. Is that an original concept?
It is. The idea is not original to us, fast casual gourmet salad. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Vinaigrette Salad Kitchen is our own brand that we started.
Tell us a little bit about the background of conceiving something like that and then actually starting it up.
Well, it's a good story in entrepreneurial endeavors of failure that produces something once you pivot. We started with the idea that we would love to be able to do something with local food and source from local farmers. Kentucky is such a rich place for that. And we love the idea of doing good and helping and helping the economy in general. So our idea first was to source a local supermarket or something of that nature from local farms. So we tried our hand at it with very low overhead and cost at the mall, at Fayette Mall. We started this little, almost like a fruit stand, and quickly realized that people did not come to the mall to buy local honey and berries. So we tried that for a few months and it didn't go over so well, but we had made all these wonderful contacts with farmers throughout Kentucky, and we thought, how can we now turn that into something? And that's where Vinaigrette Salad Kitchen came from.
Would you say to be a successful entrepreneur, you have to have sort of an innate tolerance for risk?
Yeah, I think there's different levels. For instance, my brother owns a Chick-fil-A in Hopkinsville, but there's a little bit of risk. You have to put a little bit of money in, but it's really owned by Chick-fil-A and the Cathys. Whereas whenever we started, it's 100% us. And so, yeah, I think your risk tolerance has to be, you know, pretty high to be able to get into entrepreneurial endeavors for sure.
So back to Vinaigrette, how many locations and are you expanding that?
So originally it was funded just by us. We took one of our orange leaves, cut it in half on Leestown Road. It was a big space, too big probably for orange leaf. We cut that in half. So we didn't pay more in rent at that point just to test it and see if it worked. And as it started working, we expanded that to that location. That got to a certain point before we started to expand beyond that. Then we opened at the Square and opened Hamburg, Palomar, and one in Louisville. We're currently working on one in Cincinnati as well.
So getting away from the food side of things, you also have Breakout Games. Is that an original enterprise?
That is an original enterprise as well, yeah.
Tell us what Breakout Games is.
Well, it's an escape game. We lock you in a room for an hour, not literally lock, but we put you in a room for an hour, and it's a series of puzzles and riddles and clues. There's a theme, and you have to figure out what's going on. You literally know nothing about what's going on when you enter that room other than the theme. And everything you need to get out of that room is inside that room. And you're just trying to figure out what the final clue is to punch in the door and get out.
And where are Breakout Games locations? Are there multiple locations?
Yeah, so we have 45 locations across the country, mainly on the east side of the country, all the way from Boston to Florida, over Minnesota, Oklahoma City, Dallas.
It's an exploding genre, isn't it?
It is. It's very interesting. It's been popular in Asia, Europe for, 7 to 10 years. So it's made its way into America about four and a half years ago.
Has it exceeded your expectations? It sounds as though it really expanded. Did it go beyond what you thought it might?
Yeah, we've had a lot of success. It's been really fun, and it's fun for us to watch an entertainment business that is appealing to all family members. So we love to watch grandparents bring grandkids in there. There's no cell phones for an hour. So no one can be on their phone. They're all having to talk to work together to get out of that room. And it's been fun to see. And I think it appeals to across generations. It appeals to everyone, which is really cool.
So as I understand it, you're expanding your gaming business into another concept called Color Chaos. And I think the first location is on North Ashland in Lexington. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that's a new idea that is a lot of fun as well. It's different than an escape game. You have five rooms, and you go through all five rooms. You have 10 minutes in each room, and it's kind of like entering a video game, and you keep score. When you go in, you know exactly what you're supposed to do. You're just trying to get as high a score as possible. So one of the most popular rooms that we have is a laser maze, and it makes you feel like you're in one of those movies where you're going back and forth in a laser maze, and you have to hit buttons and do all these things, crawl on the floor. And the very end, the final climax is you get put in a hazmat suit, you play this game, and you get hit with paint. So paint explodes all over you at the very end. It's a lot of fun.
And so what's the target market for that?
That is pretty much the same target market. We've been open for a couple of weeks now, and it's families coming in. It might be a little bit younger. We're saying that younger kids around 10 years old love to play the games.
And so this is the beta, so to speak, here. And there aren't other Color Chaos locations yet?
This is the only one, yes.
Okay. And you hope to take it beyond that?
Well, yeah, we would love to.
So what's your take on Lexington as a place to launch and to grow a concept like that?
You know, Lexington is a really friendly place to start up. So there's a lot of friendly startup businesses and community in Lexington, a lot of people that are willing to help. I love the fact that there's a lot of camaraderie in Lexington as well. It's not like a strong competition. It's everybody's helping each other get ahead. And when we launch something in Lexington, Lexingtonians get behind it. Vinaigrette Breakout, and it's been a wonderful place to start businesses.
All right. Jason Thompson is owner-operator of Orange Consulting in Lexington. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ashton Potter Wright has a lot on her plate. She's Lexington's local food coordinator, and she's in charge of Bluegrass Farm to Table, working with the staffs of the mayor's office and the Lexington-Fayette Urban County Council in support of food-related agricultural development. Thanks for joining us, Ashton. So we have a lot to talk about, and let's begin with a little bit of background on Bluegrass Farm to Table.
Sure. Well, Bluegrass Farm to Table started in 2014 as an effort to connect more farmers and local food producers with different market channels. So again, as you mentioned, to develop a more vibrant local food economy here in Lexington and Central Kentucky.
So you've been at this for 5 years now.
Yes.
I'm sure you've seen a lot of growth and development going on.
Yes, there's been a lot of progress. Still a lot of work left to do, but we feel like we've made some really good strides in the last 4.5 years.
How would you describe the culture as far as farm to table and community supported agriculture, the idea of agriculture being a part of our culture here in Lexington?
Well, certainly Fayette County and Kentucky as a whole, we obviously have a very rich agricultural history, which we're very proud of. And I think local restaurateurs and other businesses are really doing their part to highlight our local farmers and food producers, and that really goes a long way.
You have a lot of events coming up. It looks like March is really busy for you. And these are some things that people might want to pop onto their calendars. So let's go through them. First of all is a sign-up event for Community Supported Agriculture, CSA. For those who may not know what that is, can you tell us about it?
Sure. So CSA stands for, as you mentioned, Community Supported Agriculture. And it's essentially a produce subscription to the farm's weekly harvest. And so you sign up in advance of the main growing season, which here in Kentucky is usually 20 to 22 weeks, May to October, give or take a few weeks, depending on the weather. And payment is made up front for the entire growing season to the farm. And that really helps them prepare financially for the upcoming season, buy all the things they need to make sure that you have the very best of Kentucky agriculture in your boxes every week. And so it's really a really good direct connection with who's growing your food, and you really learn about how it's grown and the values that farm is promulgating. So our event on March 7th is at West 6 Brewing. This will be the fourth year we've hosted this event. We're really excited about it in partnership with the Center for Crop Diversification at UK. And really, it's an informal opportunity for consumers to interact with farmers who are offering CSA shares in the Lexington area. And they can learn more about the different CSA options, what they can expect to see in their boxes every week. And hopefully, the goal is to have lots of folks sign up for their shares.
How many farms participate?
So this year, we have 14 farms, which we're really excited about. They offer vegetables, produce, meat, eggs. We actually have a raw milk producer there as well. And so they really have a lot of variety. And I think something that's really exciting, so CSA typically is you get what you get, right? The farmers curate the box for you every week. And a lot of our farmers, not all, but a lot of them are really working to customize those shares and allowing consumers more choices in what they see in their boxes every week. A lot of the farms are also offering CSA shares beyond the typical summer growing season. So they're offering spring and fall and even winter CSA shares. So you really can eat healthy, fresh local food year round.
I know that the one that we subscribe to, and I don't want to promote one over the others, but the one that we subscribe to includes a recipe.
Yes.
For what's in the box.
Yes, and that's really important. For a lot of people who haven't participated in CSA before, it can be a little overwhelming and a little challenging if you get some vegetables that maybe you haven't worked with before or don't know how to prepare. So all the farms really try to provide that weekly newsletter to not only let you know what's in the box, but how to prepare it and really get you to try some new recipes.
Okay, and that sign-up is at West 6th Street.
Yes, March 7th at from 5 to 7 in the Beer Garden at West 6th.
Okay, and you can find a flyer about this event on es@weku.com and also on your website, I'm sure. On our site, it'll be under the Facts and Information tab. So speaking of CSAs, what is the Kentucky Farm Share Coalition?
Well, thanks for asking. The Kentucky Farm Share Coalition is a workplace wellness CSA program that partners with employers to provide incentives, typically in the amount of $200 per employee, to a subset of their employees towards the purchase of a CSA share from a participating local farm. And then for 20 to 22 weeks of the growing season, employees enjoy convenient workplace pickup of their own box of locally grown organic vegetables. And when 6.3 of Kentucky's adults don't meet the daily recommended vegetable intake, and so many struggle with diet-related illnesses, this is a really low-cost way to invest in employees' health and support our local food economy.
So you can do this at work.
Yes, you can. And the city, I'm very proud to report, we've been offering this incentive program to a subset of our employees for the past we're going into year three. So we started in 2017 offering it to 100 employees. And this year and last year, we offered it to 150.
Any other workplaces around the area doing it?
Yes. So the University of Kentucky was kind of the pioneer and have been doing it the longest. The Lexington and Fayette County Health Department will be doing a small pilot this year. Valvoline Headquarters is participating, as well as a couple of other employers.
Okay. Coming up later on in March, the Kentucky Food Systems Summit. What's that all about?
So we are really excited about this summit that we are hosting in partnership with the Food Connection at the University of Kentucky and Bluegrass Tomorrow. So this is a one-day summit designed to bring together local food systems practitioners, researchers, extension agents to share research findings, innovative programs, and best practices around local food systems development.
I wanted to make sure that I left plenty of time to talk about this. I know that Mayor Linda Gorton has made agricultural technology, ag tech, one of her top priorities, and that is to develop some sort of organizing structure to enable collaboration and communication among our various ag tech assets. And we have many of them here, from education and research at the universities to private sector players such as Alltech and even Space Tango. We're sending UK ag research up into space. What's your role in this, and what's happening toward meeting this goal?
Well, Mayor Gorton has asked me to work on developing a plan in close partnership with some of those folks you mentioned. Agriculture Commissioner Ryan Quarles is heavily involved, Dean Nancy Cox at the UK College of Ag, Food, and Environment, and Dr. Mark Lyons at Alltech. These are folks who are all kind of leading the way, and we want to intentionally partner with these folks to develop a more comprehensive, streamlined plan to really further position Lexington as a hub of high-tech agriculture, and we think we're well poised to do that.
I know that a few years ago, Dr. Pierce Lyons, Mark Lyons' father, his late father, had this idea that we ought to become a hub for agricultural technology. And it was a mission of his. Some of the constituents who come to the annual Alltech Symposium 1 have talked about it. And I don't know, it just makes sense. We are an agrarian community here.
Absolutely. We certainly are. We have a lot of really important assets already in place, and we're kind of at the cusp. And we really, we hope with the city's involvement and bringing together these partners, that we'll really come up with a really great plan to move Lexington forward on this initiative.
I'm betting you really enjoy your work.
I do.
What about it? Anything in particular?
Well, I really like working with people, in particular farmers, and I love working directly with them and helping them sell their story and helping to connect more people with knowing where their food comes from.
Lexington Local Food Coordinator Ashton Potter-Wright, thanks for joining us, Ashton.
Thanks for having me.
A couple of corrections. In last week's show, I said that Katina Haynes is from Harlan. Well, she works there, but she lives in Cumberland, Kentucky. And I failed to mention the date for the upcoming TEDx event in Corbin. That's happening on Saturday, March 9th at the event space 2nd and Main on Main Street in downtown Corbin, Kentucky. That's it for this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of 1, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. Information about Eastern Standard content partnerships can be found online at esweku.com. And now you can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app, available for Apple and Android devices. Eastern Standard's also available as a podcast, and you'll find us on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.